real father, the mother will laugh and drop the little crumb snatcher, shit-filled diaper and all, into my waiting arms. Usually it isn't so simple. Most times, there's so much Nina Simone, Mississippi goddamn despondency in the night air, it becomes hard to focus. The deep purple contusions about the face and arms, the terry cloth robe finally falling seductively off the shoulders, revealing the woman to be a man with hormonally induced breasts, shaved pubes, surprisingly shapely hips, and a tire iron brandishing significant other who, underneath that bulky sweatshirt and baseball cap cocked to the side, might be a man or just mannish, but either way is maniacally pacing the carport, threatening to bash in my skull if I say the wrong thing. The baby, swaddled in blue because blue is for crip-centric boys, will be either too fat or too skinny, crying its little lungs out so loudly you'd wish it'd shut up, or even worse, so bone-chillingly quiet that under the circumstances you think it must already be dead. And invariably, softly in the background, billowing the curtains through the parted, sliding glass doors, there's always Nina Simone. These are the women my father warned me about. The drug and asshole-addled women who sit in the dark, hard up and lovesick, chain-smoking cigarettes, phones pressed to their ears, speed-dialing K-Earth 101 FM, the oldie station, so they can request Nina Simone or the Shirelles, "This is dedicated to the one I love," a.k.a. "This is dedicated to niggers that beat me senseless and leave." Stay away from bitches who love Nina Simone and have faggots for best friends, he'd say. They hate men. Swinging by its tiny heels, the baby carves giant, parabolic, fast-pitch softball windmill circles in the air, and I stand there useless, a vacant look on my face, a nigger whisperer without secrets and sweet nothings to whisper. The crowd murmurs that I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't.
You don't stop fucking around, man, you're gonna get that baby killed.
Killed.
Whatever, nigga, just say something.
They all think that after my dad died, I went away to college, majored in psychology, and returned to continue his good work. But I have no interest in psychoanalytic theory, ink splotches, the human condition, and in giving something back to the community. I went to the University of California at Riverside because it had a decent agricultural studies department. Majored in animal sciences with dreams of turning daddy's land into a hatchery where I could sell ostriches to all the early 90s heavy rotation rappers. First round draft choices and big budget movie sidekicks eager to invest their skrilla and who, after flying first class for the first time in their lives, laid down the dog-eared financial section of the in-flight magazine in their laps and thought to themselves, shit, ostrich meat is indeed the future. It sounds like a financial no-brainer. A nutritious FDA-approved ostrich steak sells for $20 a pound. The feathers go for $5 a piece, and those bumpy brown leather hides are worth $200 each. But the real money would be on my end in selling breeders to the nouveau nigger riche. Because the average bird yields only about 40 pounds of edible meat. Because Oscar Wilde is dead. And no one wears plumage and feathered hats anymore except for drag queens over 40, Bavarian tuba players, Marcus Garvey impersonators, and mint julep-sipping Kentucky Derby trifecta-betting Southern belles who wouldn't buy black if you were selling the secret to ageless, wrinkle-free skin and 9 inches of dick. I knew full well the birds are impossible to raise, and I didn't have the startup capital, but let's just say my sophomore year, the UC Riverside small farm program was missing a few two-legged dissertations, because like the drug dealers say, if I don't do it, somebody else will. And believe me when I tell you that to this day, the cracked and abandoned nest eggs of many a bankrupt one-hit wonder run wild in the San Gabriel Mountains.
I don't know what to say. Didn't you major in psychology like your daddy?
All I know is a little animal husbandry.
Shit. Being married to these animals is what gets these bitches into trouble in the first place, so you best say something to this heifer.
I minored in crop sciences and management because Professor Farley, my intro to agronomy teacher, said that I was a natural horticulturist. That I could be the next George Washington Carver if I wanted to be. All I needed to do was apply myself and find my own equivalent to the peanut. A legume of my own, she joked, placing a single Phaseolus vulgaris into my palm. But anyone who'd ever been to Tito's Tacos and tasted a warm cupful of the greasy, creamy, refried frijole slop covered in a solid half-inch of melted cheddar cheese knew the bean had already reached genetic perfection. I remember wondering, why George Washington Carver? Why couldn't I have been the next Gregor Mendel? The next whoever it was that invented the chia pet? And even though nobody remembers Captain Kangaroo, the next Mr. Green Jeans? So I chose to specialize in the plant life that had the most cultural relevance to me. Watermelon and weed. At best, I'm a subsistence farmer. But 3 or 4 times a year, I'll hitch a horse to the wagon and clomp through Dickens, hawking my wares. Mongo Santa Maria's Watermelon Man blasting from the boombox. That song pounding in the distance has been known to stop summer league basketball games mid-fast break, and many a ding-dong ditch, double-dutch marathon early, and force the women and children waiting at the intersection of Compton and Firestone for the last weekend visitation bus to the L.A. County Jail to make a difficult decision. Although they're not hard to grow, and I've been selling them for years, folks still go crazy at the sight of a square watermelon. And like that black president, you think that after 2 terms of looking at a dude in a suit deliver the State of the Union address, you get used to square watermelons, but somehow you never do. The pyramidal shapes are big sellers also. And around Easter, I sell bunny rabbit-shaped ones that I've genetically altered so that if you squint, the dark lines in the rind spell out Jesus saves. Those I can't keep on the wagon, but it's the taste that keeps them coming back. Think of the best watermelon you've ever had. Now add a hint of anise and brown sugar. Seeds that you're reluctant to spit out because they cool your mouth like the last sweet remnants of a cola-covered ice cube melting on the tip of your tongue. I've never seen it, but they say people have bitten into my watermelon and fainted straight away. That paramedics, fresh from CPR rescues of customers nearly drowned in 6 inches of blue backyard plastic wading pool water, don't ask about heat stroke or a family history of heart disease. Their faces covered in sticky red remnants of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation nectar, their cheeks freckled with black seeds. They stop licking their lips only long enough to ask, "Where did you get the watermelon?" Sometimes, when I'm in an unfamiliar neighborhood looking for a stray goat on the Latino side of Harris Avenue, a clique of peewees fresh out of cholo school, their newly shorn scalps gleaming in the sun, will step to me, grab me by the shoulders, and with a forceful reverence say, "Por la sandilla, gracias." But even in sunny California, you can't grow watermelon year-round. The winter nights are colder than people think. 20-pound melons take forever to mature, and they suck nitrate out of the soil like it's sodium crack. So it's the marijuana that's my mainstay. I rarely sell it. Weed isn't a cash crop, but more like a gas money one. Plus, I don't want motherfuckers running up on me in the middle of the night. Occasionally, I'll pull out an eighth, and the unsuspecting homie who's been weaned on the chronic, and who now lies on my front lawn covered in dirt and grass, laughing his ass off, his legs entwined in the frame of the bicycle he's forgotten how to ride, will proudly hold up the joint he never dropped and ask me, "What this shit called?" "Ataxia," I'll say. On the house party dance floor, when La Giggles, whom I've known since 2nd grade, finally stops staring incessantly into her compact mirror at a face she likes but doesn't quite recognize, she turns to me and asks 3 questions. Who am I? And who this nigger sticking his tongue in my ear, grinding on my ass? And what the fuck am I smoking? The answers to her questions are Bridget La Giggles Sanchez, your husband, and Prostopagnosia. Sometimes folks wonder why I always have the kind bird, but any suspicious curiosity can be allayed with a shrug of the shoulders and a deadpan, oh, I know some white boys. Light up a joint, exhale. Weed that smells bad is good, and a dank, wispy cloud of smoke that smells like red tide at Huntington Beach, dead fish and seagulls roasting in the hot sun, will make a woman stop twirling her baby. Offer her a hit, sloppy end first. She'll nod. It's Anglophobia, a strain that I've just developed, but she doesn't need to know that. Anything that will allow me to come closer is a good thing. Approach in peace and climb the ivory-covered latticework, or stand on some big nigger's shoulders and put myself within arm's reach so that I can touch her. Stroke her with techniques that are basically the same ones I used on the thoroughbreds at school after a work-study day of galloping and breezing horses in the fields. Rub her ears. Blow gently into her nostrils. Work her joints. Brush her hair. Shotgun weed smoke into her pursed and needy lips. When she hands me the baby, and I descend the stairs into the applause of the awaiting crowd, I'd like to think that Gregor Mendel, George Washington Carver, and even my father would be proud. And sometime, while they're being strapped to the gurney or consoled by a distraught grandmother, I'll ask them, why Wednesday? Chapter 5. Dickens's Evanesce hit some folks harder than others. But the citizen who needed my services the most was old man Hominy Jenkins. Hominy had always been a little unstable, but my father never really dealt with him. I don't think he thought losing a gray-haired relic to Uncle Tom's past would be any great loss to the neighborhood, so it'd be up to me to go get that fool nigger. I guess, in a sense, Hominy was my first nigger whisperee. I can't count how many times I had to wrap a blanket around him because he was trying to commit suicide by gangbanger, by wearing red in the blue neighborhoods, blue in the red, or shouting, Yo soy el gran pinche mayate. Julio César Chávez es un puto. In the brown. He used to climb palm trees and recite Tarzan lines to the natives. Me, Tarzan. You, Shaniqua. And I'd have to beg every woman in the neighborhood to lower her gun and coax Hominy down with a phony contract from a long-dead movie studio, front-loaded with beer and smokehouse almond signing bonuses. One Halloween, he yanked the doorbell wires from his living room wall and attached them to his testes. So when the trick-or-treaters rang the buzzer, instead of candy and an autographed photo, they got blood-curdling screams that continued until I fought my way through the sadistic throng of fairy godmothers and superheroes and pulled She-Hulk's green 8-year-old finger away from the ringer long enough for me to talk Hominy into pulling his pants up and the shades down. As the supposed murder capital of the world, Dickens never got much tourist trade. Occasionally, a pack of college kids vacationing in Los Angeles for the first time would stop at a busy intersection just long enough to shoot 20 seconds of shaky handheld video of them jumping up and down, whooping like crazed savages, shouting, Check us out! We're in Dickens, California! What you know about that, fool? Then post the footage of their urban safari on the internet. But when all the Welcome to Dickens signs were removed, there was no Blarney Stone to kiss. The urban voyeurs stopped coming. Sometimes genuine sightseers did come through. Mostly old and pensioned, they'd troll the streets in their out-of-state license-plated RVs looking for the last link to their youths. Those halcyon days, the campaign politicians always promised to take us back to when America was powerful and respected. A land of morals and virtue and cheap gas. And asking a local, excuse me, do you know where I can find Hominy? was like asking some penny-ante lounge singer if they knew the way to San Jose. Hominy Jenkins is the last surviving member of the Little Rascals, that madcap posse of street urchins who, from the roaring 20s until the Reaganomics 80s, flummoxed pot-bellied coppers, ditching school 7 days a week and twice on Sundays on matinee movie screens and after-school televisions around the world. Signed by Hal Roach Studios in the mid-1930s, at a reputed $350 a week to be Buckwheat Thomas's understudy, Hominy cashed his checks and bided his time by playing minor roles. The silent little brother who had to be babysat while mother was away visiting Papa in jail. The colored kid on the ass end of the runaway mule. He made do delivering the occasional throwaway one-liner from the back of the one-room schoolhouse, acknowledging talking babies, wild men from Borneo, and Alfalfa's soap bubble solos with an exaggerated roll of the eyeballs and his trademark, yowza. The underutilization of his sooty black cuteness made bearable with the knowledge that one day, soon, he'd step into the oversized, curly-toed genie shoes of the great pickaninnies that preceded him. Take his rightful place in the wisecracking pantheon of Farina, Stymie, and Buckwheat, and carry the legacy of bowler-hatted ragamuffin racism well into the 1950s. But the era of the human gollywog and the one-reeler died before his turn came. Hollywood had all the blackness it needed in the demi-whiteness of Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, the brooding negritude of James Dean, and the broad, gravity-defying Venus hot-to-trot roundness of Marilyn Monroe's ass. When they found his house, Hominy would greet his devotees with a wide, polydent smile and an arthritic, finger-wiggling high sign, inviting them in for high C fruit punch and, if they were lucky, slices of my watermelon. I doubt that he told his aging fan base the same stories he shared with us. It's hard to say what started the love affair between me and Marpessa Delissa Dawson. She's 3 years older than me, and I've known her all my life. A lifelong resident of the farms. Her mother ran the Sun-to-Sun Equestrian and Polo School from their backyard. They used to call me whenever they were short a show jumper or a number four on the junior spear chuckers. I wasn't much good at either, because Appaloosas are shitty jumpers, and using your left hand is illegal in polo. When we were younger, me, Marpessa, and the rest of the kids on the block would jet over to Hominy's house after school, because what could be cooler than watching an hour of Little Rascals with a little rascal? In those days, when remote-controlled television was your father screaming, "Sean, Don, Mark, one of you motherfuckers come downstairs and change this goddamn channel." Fine-tuning a fickle ultra-high-frequency station like Channel 52 KBSC TV Corona Los Angeles on a beat-up, black-and-white portable missing one rabbit-ear antenna and all its dials required a vascular surgeon's touch. It took forever to finagle a set of plumbing pliers around the stubby metal knobs, looking for any angularity that might result in the weeest bit of a channel-changing torque or vertical and horizontal hold. But when the opening title sequence, accompanied by the drunken warbling horns in the R-Gang theme song, popped up on the TV, we'd settle in around gray-haired Hominy and those red-hot space heater coils like slave children gathered round old Remus and his fire.
"Tell us another story, Uncle Remus. We means Hominy."
"I'll ever tell you all about the time I fucked the shit out of Donna on the He-Man Woman Haters Club set during our 20th reunion."
I didn't realize it then, but Hominy, like any other child star still standing in the Klieg-light afterglow of a long-ago canceled career, was batshit crazy. We thought that he was being funny, dry-humping the TV with every low-angle shot of Darla's exposed lace panties.
In real life, that bitch wasn't as stingy with the pussy as she was in the movies.
Slamming his pelvis into the screen, shouting,
"That's for Alfalfa, Mickey, Porky, Chubby, Froggy, Butch, that stuck-up punk Wally, and the rest of the gang."
Punctuating his blue balls roll call with increasingly violent thrusts. Needless to say, there's an anger to Hominy. One that comes from not being as famous as you think you should be.
When he wasn't reminiscing about his sexual conquests, Hominy liked to brag about how he was fluent in four languages, because they shot each short four times, once in English, French, Spanish, and German. The first time he told us this, we laughed in his face, because all his mentor Buckwheat did was flash his greasy gap-toothed grin and say, "Okay, Panky," in that marble-mouthed pickaninny pluperfect of his. And okay, Spanky is okay, Spanky in any fucking language.
Once, one of my favorite episodes, Mush and Milk, was on, and to prove his boast, Hominy turned down the volume just as the gang sat around the Bleak Hill boarding school breakfast table. Kindly, old Cap was waiting on his back pension. The house mother, wrinkled and as temperamental as a dog-pound Sharpei, spat and hissed at the kids, one of whom, having screwed up the morning chores, whispers into another urchin's ear a line we didn't need sound to hear because we'd heard it a million times.
"Don't drink the milk," we said aloud.
"Why?"
a tow-headed white boy mouthed.
"It's spoiled,"
we whispered in unison. "Don't drink the milk, pass it on," and Hominy did just that, dubbing each waif's warning to the next rascal down in a different language.
"No bebas la leche. ¿Por qué? Está mala. Ne bois pas la leche. Pourquoi? C'est gâté. Trink die milch nicht. Warum? Die ist schlecht."
Don't drink the milk. Why? It's spoiled. The milk was spoiled because in reality it was liquefied plaster of Paris that hadn't yet hardened into a sight gag, and child stardom spoiled Hominy. Sometimes after a particularly abrupt edit for the sake of political correctness, he'd stomp his feet and pout.
"I was in that scene. They edited me out. Spanky finds Aladdin's lamp. He rubs it and says, 'I wish Hominy was a monkey. I wish Hominy was a monkey.' And lo and motherfucking behold, I'm a motherfucking monkey."
"A monkey?"
"A capuchin, to be exact. And my method-acting monkey ass hit the streets running, baby. And I comes across a nigger soda jerk making time with his old lady. He closes his eyes, leans in for a little loving. She sees me, splits, and that fool plants a wet one right on my big pink simian lips. That had them rolling in the aisles. A lad in a lamp. Most screen time I ever had. I fought the whole damn police force, and by the end of the picture, me and Spanky eating cake and shit and running the whole goddamn town. And let me tell you, Spanky was without question the coolest motherfucking white boy ever. Yowza."
It was hard to determine if he'd been turned into a real monkey, or if Hal Roach Studios, never known for its extravagant special effects, just opened up the timeless cookbook of classic American stereotyping and turned to the one-step recipe for Negro monkey shines. 1. Just add tail. Whatever the case, as the celluloid snippets of censored slapstick racism piled up on the cutting room floor, it became apparent that Hominy was a sort of little rascal stunt coon. His film career was a compendium of unseen outtakes where he's doused with all things white, sunny-side-up eggs, paint, and pancake flour avalanches. Eyeballs bulging with fear and hyperthyroidism, sometimes the sight of a ghost in an abandoned house or a congregation of newly baptized Holy Ghost Negroes speaking in tongues and somnambulating through the thick of the local forest, or a white nightshirt blowing eerily on a clothesline like a hoodoo ghost come to billowing life would scare the shit out of Hominy, turn him albino white. Blow out his afro to freakishly long, scared straight proportions and send him running headlong into a swamp tree through a wooden fence or a plate glass window. And he was constantly being electrocuted, both by his own ineptitude and by acts of God, whose supposedly random lightning strike somehow never failed to miss the crack of his suspender pants covered ass. In Frankly Ben Franklin, after the prototype is chewed up by Petey the Pitbull, who else but Hominy would volunteer to be the bespectacled Spanky's kite? sewn spread eagle onto a giant Betsy Ross flag, wearing nothing but a set of tattered slave breeches, a tricomb hat with a metal rod sticking out of its crown, and a placard hanging from his neck that in runny ink reads, "These are the times that fry men's souls, Nathan Hale." He soars high in the sky, a flying black squirrel sailing through the stinging rain, gale force winds, and the fusillade of lightning bolts. There's a thunderclap, followed by a cloud of sparks, and Spanky, examining a glowing, electrified skeleton key attached to the kite string, "Eureka," he's about to say. Before he's rudely interrupted from above, where Harmony, stuck in the tree branches, a smoldering, ashen heap, smoke billowing from every orifice, eyes and teeth forever phosphorescent, delivers the longest line of his career.
"Yowza! I done discovered electricity!"
Over time, with the advent of cable television, home video games, and Melanie Price's bodacious eighth-grade bosoms, which she liked to show off in bedroom window striptease acts that started at the exact same time the Little Rascals did, one by one, the gang stopped visiting Harmony after school, until it was only me and Marpessa left. I'm not sure why she stayed. She had her own 15-year-old tube-top breast to show off. Sometimes the older guys would come up to the door and ask her to come outside to talk, but she'd always wait until the Little Rascals was over, leaving the homeboys on Harmony's porch. I'd like to think that Marpessa liked me even then, but I know it was probably pity and a sense of safety that kept her around from 3:30 to 4, munching on grapes and watching the gang put on extravagant backyard variety shows featuring raspy-voiced 7-year-olds and colored kids tap-dancing up a storm. What harm could a 13-year-old homeschooled farm boy and superannuated coon do?
"Marpessa?"
"Huh?"
"Wipe your chin. It's wet."
"Let me tell you, that's not all that's wet. That's how good these goddamn grapes is." "You really grow these yourself?"
"Yep."
"Why?"
"Homework."
"Your father's fucking crazy." I suppose that's what I first loved about Marpessa, her unabashed inappropriateness. I guess I loved her titties, too. Although, like she said whenever she caught me staring at them, I wouldn't know what to do with them if I ever had half the chance. Eventually, the lure of older boys with drug money and sperm counts outweighed the sonorous charms of alfalfa in a cowboy hat singing "Home on the Range," and for the longest time, it was just me, Harmony, and the grapes. I never regretted passing up the side yard peep shows with my friends. I always figured that if Marpessa kept eating my grapes and drooling nectar down her ample chest, sooner or later, those drill-bit hard nipples would bore through the wet spots on her shirt. Sadly, I never saw a three-dimensional mammary until the eve of my 16th birthday, when I woke up one night to find Tasha, one of my dad's teaching assistants, sitting on the edge of my bed, naked, reeking of postcoital must and muscatel, and reading Nancy Chodorow aloud.
"Mothers
are women, of course,
because a mother is a female parent. We can talk about a man mothering a child if he is this child's primary nurturing figure or is acting in a nurturant manner, but we would never talk about a woman fathering a child."
To this day, whenever I'm lonely, I touch myself thinking about Tasha's titty and how Freudian hermeneutics doesn't apply to Dickens. A place where, often as not, it's the child who raises the parents, where the Oedipus and Electra complexes are simple. Sons, daughters, step-parents, or play-cousins, it doesn't matter, since everybody's fucking each other over and penis envy doesn't exist, because sometimes niggas just got too much dick. I don't know exactly why, but I felt like I owed Harmony something for all those afternoons Marpessa and I spent at his house. That there's something about the craziness that he had to go through that's kept me relatively sane. And one blustery Wednesday morning, about 3 years ago, during a well-earned afternoon nap, I heard my pacer's voice in my sleep. "Harmony," was all she said. After scrambling outside, I found a hastily written sign, scotch taped to Harmony's screen door, fluttering in the breeze. "Eyes in de back," it read. His penmanship, typical little rascal, squiggly yet surprisingly legible. The back was Harmony's memorabilia room. A small 15x15 add-on that was once crammed with a treasure trove of R-Gang props, headshots, and costumes. There weren't many memories left. Most, like the suit of armor from which Spanky recited Mark Antony's soliloquy in Shivering Shakespeare under a barrage of pea shooters, the lock of Alfalfa's personality, the top hat and tails Buckwheat wore when he conducted the Club Spanky Big Band and made hundreds and thousands of dollars in the R-Gang Follies of 1938. The long-ass hook-and-ladder scrap metal fire engine used to win Jane back from the rich kid with the real fire engine, and the kazoos, flutes, and spoons that made up the wind and rhythm sections of the International Silver String Band had been long pawned and auctioned off. As advertised, Harmony was indeed in de back, buck naked and hanging by his neck from a wooden beam. 2 feet away from him sat a folding chair marked reserved, and on its seat a photocopy playbill for Curtain Call, a one act of desperation. The noose was a bungee cord stretched to its bike rack limit, so much so that if he'd worn anything bigger than a size 8 shoe, his toes would have touched the ground. His face turning a deep shade of blue, I watched him twist in the draft. I had half a mind to let him die.
"Cut my penis off and stuff it into my mouth,"
he rasped with what air was left in his lungs. Apparently asphyxiation makes your penis hard, and his brown member sprouted like a twig from a frizzy snowball of shock-white pubic hair. Like an antique whirligig, he kicked about frantically, as much from his simultaneous attempt to burn himself in effigy as from the paucity of oxygen reaching his already Alzheimer's brain. Fuck the white man's burden. Harmony Jenkins was my burden, and I knocked the can of kerosene and the lighter from his hand. Walked, not ran, back home to look for the gardening shears and some skin lotion, taking my sweet time because I knew that racist Negro archetypes like Bebe's kids don't die, they multiply, because the kerosene splashed on my shirt smelled like Zima, but mostly because my father said he never panicked when someone from the neighborhood tried to hang themselves because, for the life of them, black people can't tie knots for shit. I cut the self-lynching drama queen down, lowered him gently to the rayon-carpeted floor, and coddled his scraggly head. He filled my armpit with snot and tears as I rubbed cortisone into his rope-chafed neck and flipped through the playbill. On page 2 was a publicity shot of our boy chilling with the Marx Brothers on the set of the unreleased sequel to A Day at the Races, called A Day Among the Races. The Marx Brothers sit in backward-facing director's chairs labeled Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo. At the lineup's far end is a high chair whose back reads Depresso. In it, sitting cross-legged, is 6-year-old Harmony, a thick white Groucho mustache painted on his upper lip. The photo is signed to Harmony Jenkins, the Schwarze Sheep of the family. Best wishes from the Marxists. Groucho, Carl, Skid, Italia. Below this was Harmony's bio, a sad listing of his meager screen credits that read like a suicide note. Harmony Jenkins, Harmony Jenkins. Harmony's happy to make both his theatrical debut and his swan song at the Backroom Repertory Theater. In 1933, Harmony first put his wild, unkempt afro to good use when he debuted as the wailing, abandoned native baby boy in the original King Kong. He went on to survive that near Skull Island stomping and has since specialized in portraying black boys from the ages of 8 to 80, including most notably in Black Beauty, Stable Boy, uncredited, War of the Worlds, Paperboy, uncredited. Captain Blood, Cabin Boy, uncredited. Charlie Chan joins the Klan, Busboy, uncredited. Every film shot in Los Angeles between 1937 and 1964, Shushan Boy, uncredited. Other credits include various roles as Messenger Boy, Bellboy, Busboy, Pinboy, Pool Boy, House Boy, Box Boy, Copy Boy, Delivery Boy, Boy Toy, SAG Film, Errand Boy, and Token Aerospace Engineer Boy in the Academy Award-winning film Apollo 13. He wishes to thank his many fans who have supported him throughout the years. What a long, strange trip it's been. If that naked old man crying in my lap had been born elsewhere, say, Edinburgh, maybe he'd be knighted by now. Arise, Sir Hominy of Dickens, Sir Jig of Boo, Sir Bo of Zo. If he were Japanese and had managed to survive the war, the economic bubble and shonen knife, then it's quite possible he'd be one of those octogenarian kabuki actors who, when he enters during the second act of Kyo Ningyo, the play comes to a reverential halt as the announcer introduces him to great fanfare and a government stipend. Playing the role of courtesan Oguruma, the Kyoto doll, is Japanese living national treasure Hominy Kokojin Jenkins the Eighth. But he had the misfortune of being born in Dickens, California. And in America, Hominy is no source of pride. He's a living national embarrassment. A mark of shame on the African-American legacy. Something to be eradicated, stricken from the racial record, like the ham bone, Amos and Andy, Dave Chappelle's meltdown, and people who say Valentine's Day. I placed my mouth to the waxy folds of Hominy's ear. Why, Hominy? I couldn't tell if he'd understood me. There was only that minstrel smile, pearly white, wide and servile, beaming blankly back at me. It's crazy how, in a way, child actors never seem to age. There's always one feature that refuses to grow old and marks them forever young, if not forgotten. Think Gary Coleman's cheeks, Shirley Temple's pug nose, Eddie Munster's widow's peak, Brooke Shields' flat-chestedness, and Hominy Jenkins's effervescent smile. Why, massa? Because when Dickens disappeared, I disappeared. I don't get fan mail anymore. I haven't had a visitor in 10 years, 'cause don't nobody know where to find me. I just want to feel relevant. Is that too much for an old goon to ask, massa? To feel relevant? I shook my head no, but I had one more question. And why Wednesdays? You don't know. You don't remember. It was the last talk your father gave at the Dum Dum Donuts meeting. He said that the vast majority of slave revolts took place on Wednesdays because, traditionally, Thursday was whipping day. The New York slave revolt, the L.A. riots, the Amistad, all them shits, Hominy said, grinning woodenly from ear to ear like a ventriloquist dummy. Been this way ever since we first set foot in this country. Someone's getting whipped or stopped and frisked, whether or not anyone done anything wrong. So, why not make it worthwhile and act a fool Wednesday if you're gonna get beat on Thursday, right, massa? Hominy, you're not a slave, and I'm definitely not your master. Massa, he said, the smile evaporating from his face and shaking his head in that pitiable way people you think you're better than do when they catch you thinking that you're better than them. Sometimes we just have to accept who we are and act accordingly. I'm a slave. That's who I am. It's the role I was born to play. A slave who just also happens to be an actor. But being black ain't method acting. Lee Strasberg could teach you how to be a tree, but he couldn't teach you how to be a nigger. This is the ultimate nexus between craft and purpose, and we won't be discussing this again. I'm your nigga for life, and that's it. Unable to distinguish between himself and the corny, I owe you my life, I'll be your slave trope, Hominy had finally lost his mind, and I should have hospitalized him right then and there. Called the police and had him 5150. But once, during an afternoon visit to the Cinematheque Hollywood home for the aged, forgetful, and forgotten, he made me promise that I'd never institutionalize him, because he didn't want to be exploited like his old friends Slicker Smith, Chattanooga Brown, and Beulah Mammy McQueenie, who, chasing one last film credit before heading up to that green room in the sky, auditioned from their deathbeds for novice film students from the UCLA Extension Program, looking to attach a star, even a faded-out senile one, to their certificate-earning final projects. The next morning, Thursday, I woke to Hominy standing in my front yard, shirtless and barefoot, and lashed to the curbside mailbox, demanding that I whip him. I don't know who tied his hands, but I do know that Hominy had tied mine. Master. Hominy, stop. I want to thank you for saving my life. You know I'd do anything for you. Your work with the little rascals made my childhood bearable. You want to make me happy? Yes, you know that. Then beat me. Beat me to within an inch of my worthless black life. Beat me, but don't kill me, Messer. Beat me just enough so that I can feel what I'm missing. Isn't there another way? Isn't there something else that would make you happy? Bring back Dickens. You know that's impossible. When cities disappear, they don't come back. Then you know what to do. They say it took 3 sheriff's deputies to pull me off his black ass because I whipped the shit out of that nigga. Daddy would have said that I was suffering from dissociative reaction. That's what he always attributed my beatings to. Opening up the DSM-1, a holy book of mental disorders so old it defined homosexuality as libidinal dyslexia, he'd point to dissociative reaction, then clean his glasses and begin explaining himself slowly. Dissociative reaction is like a psychic circuit breaker. When the mind experiences a power surge of stress and bullshit, it switches off, just shuts your cognition down and you blank out. You act, but are unaware of your actions. So you see, even though I don't remember dislocating your jaw, I'd love to say that I awoke from my own fugue state and remembered only the stinging fizz of my wounds as Hominy gently dabbed at my police-inflicted abrasions with cotton balls soaked in hydrogen peroxide. But as long as I live, I'll never forget the sound of my leather belt against the Levi Strauss denim as I unsheathed it from my pants. The whistle of that brown and black reversible whip cutting through the air and raining down hard in loud, skin-popping thunderclaps on Hominy's back. The teary-eyed joy and the thankfulness he showed me as he crawled, not away from the beating, but into it, seeking closure for centuries of repressed anger and decades of unrequited subservience by hugging me at the knees and begging me to hit him harder, his black body welcoming the weight and sizzle of my whip with groveling groans of ecstasy. I'll never forget Hominy bleeding in the street and, like every slave throughout history, refusing to press charges. I'll never forget him walking me gently inside and asking those who'd gathered around not to judge me because, after all, who whispers in the nigger whisperer's ear? Hominy?
Yes, Massa.
What would you whisper in my ear?
I'd whisper that you're thinking too small. That saving Dickens nigger by nigger with a bullhorn ain't never gonna work. That you have to think bigger than your father did. You know the phrase, you can't see the forest for the trees?
Of course.
Well,
You have to stop seeing us as individuals. 'Cause right now, massa, you ain't seeing the plantation for the niggers. Chapter 6. They say pimping ain't easy. Well, neither is slaveholding. Like children, dogs, dice, and overpromising politicians, and apparently prostitutes, slaves don't do what you tell them to do. And when your 80-some-odd-year-old black thrall has maybe 15 good minutes of work in him a day and enjoys the shit out of being punished, you don't get many of the plantation perks you see in the movies either. No woe-is-me, go-down-Moses-field singing. No pillowy-soft black breasts to nuzzle up to. No feather dusters. No one says by and by. No fancy dinners replete with candelabra and endless helpings of glazed ham, heaping spoonfuls of mashed potatoes, and the healthiest-looking greens known to mankind. I never got to experience any of that unquestioned trust between master and bondman. I just owned a wizened old black man who knew only one thing, his place. Hominy couldn't fix a wagon wheel, hoe a fucking row, tote barge, or lift bale. But he could genuflect his ass off, and from 1 p.m. to 1:15 p.m. or thereabouts, hat in hand, he'd show up for work, doing whatever he felt like doing. Sometimes work consisted of donning a shiny pair of emerald green and pink silks, holding a gas lamp at arm's length, and posing in my front yard as a life-size lawn jockey. Other times, he liked to serve as a human footstool, and when the spirit of servitude moved him, he dropped to all fours at the foot of my horse or the base of the pickup truck and stay there until I stepped on his back and took an unwanted trip to the liquor store or the Ontario livestock auction. But mostly, Hominy's work consisted of watching me work. Biting into Burbank plums, whose tartness to sweetness to skin thickness ratios took me 6 years to get just right, and exclaiming, "Damn, massa, these plums sure am good. They Japanese, you say. Well, you must have stuck your hand up Godzilla's asshole, 'cause you got a green thumb like a motherfucker." So, believe me when I tell you human bondage is an especially frustrating undertaking. Not that I undertook anything. My dominion over this clinically depressed bondsman having been forced upon me. And let's be clear, I tried to free Hominy countless times. Simply telling him he was free had no effect. And once, I swear I almost ditched him in the San Bernardino Mountains like an unwanted dog, but I saw a stray ostrich with a Far Side promotional bumper sticker affixed to its tail feathers, and I lost my nerve. I even had Hampton draw up some manumission papers written in industrial-age jargon, and paid some scrivener $200 to write out a contract on antique parchment paper that I found at a Beverly Hills stationery store, because apparently rich people still have use for it. What for? Who knows? Maybe with the state of the banking system, they've gone back to the treasure map. "To whom it may concern," the contract read, "with this deed I hereby emancipate, manumit, set free, permanently discharge, and dismiss my slave Hominy Jenkins, who's been in my service for the past 3 weeks. Said Hominy is of medium build, complexion, and intelligence. To all who read this, Hominy Jenkins is now a free man of color. Witness my hand on this day, October 17th, the year of 1838. The ruse didn't work. Hominy simply pulled down his pants, shit on my geraniums, and wiped his ass with his freedom, then handed it back to me.
"Medium intelligence?" he asked, raising a gray eyebrow. "One, I know what year it is. Two, true freedom is having the right to be a slave."
He hiked up his pants and slipped into his Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer plantationese.
"I know tain't nobody forcing me, but this here one slave you ain't never gwine be rid of. Freedom can kiss my postbellum black ass."
Slavery must have been profitable as hell for anybody to deal with all the mental anguish. But sometimes, after a hot day of dehorning the goats and stringing barbed wire fences, I'd be kicking back on the porch, watching the dusk scatter the smog red and heavy across the downtown sky. And Hominy would come outside with a pitcher of cold lemonade. There'd be something so satisfying about watching the condensation form and drip down the sides of the Tupperware as he slowly filled my glass, plop by painstaking ice cube plop, then fanned the horse flies and the heat from my face. In the cool air and ambient car stereo Tupac, I felt a refreshing hint of the dominion that landed Confederacy must have felt. Shit, if Hominy had always been so cooperative, I'd have fired on Fort Sumter, too. On Thursdays, accidentally, on purpose, Hominy would spill the refill in my lap, sending me a not-so-subtle message, like a dog scratching at the screen door, that it was time for some action. "Hominy."
"Yes, massa,"
he'd say hopefully, rubbing his hindquarters in preparation.
"Did you choose a counselor?"
"I looked on the internet, and the therapists are all white.
Standing in the forest or in front of a bookshelf, promising career and sexual fulfillment and healthy relationships.
How come you never see photos of them with the overachieving kids or fucking their partners to satisfaction? Where's the proof in the pudding?"
The wet patch on my pants would spread over my lap and toward my knees. "Okay, get in the truck," I'd say. Oddly, Hominy didn't seem to mind that all the dominatrices at Sticks and Stones, the BDSM club on the west side I contracted to dole out my punishments for me, were white women. The Bastille room was his favorite torture chamber. There, naked save for a Union Civil War cap, Mistress Dorothy, a pale brunette whose pouty Maybelline red lips put Scarlett O'Hara's sneer to shame, strapped him to the wheel and whipped him silly. She'd clamp some contraption about his genitals and demand intel about Union Army troop movements and armament strength. Afterward, Miss Dorothy would stick her head in the truck cab, plant a kiss on Hominy's cheek, and hand me the receipt. At $200 an hour plus racial incidentals, the shit started to add up. The first 5 coons, jigaboos, tar babies, and sambos were free. After that, it was $3 an epithet, and nigger, in any of its varied forms, derivations, and pronunciations, was $10 a pop, non-negotiable. But after these sessions, Hominy looked so happy it was almost worth it. Yet Hominy's happiness wasn't mine. It wasn't the city's, but I couldn't think of a way of restoring Dickens until one unusually warm spring evening returning home from Sticks and Stones. Hominy and I found ourselves stuck on the 110 freeway, impatiently weaving from lane to lane. We were making good progress until we hit the stretch between the 405 and 105 interchanges, and traffic began to slow. My father had a theory that poor people are the best drivers because they can't afford to carry car insurance and have to drive like they live, defensively. We were caught up in a slog of uninsured rust bucket jalopies and compacts, all doing exactly 55 miles per hour with their trash bag windshields flapping in the wind. Hominy was beginning to come down from his masochistic high, the memories, if not the pain, of his session already beginning to fade away exit by exit. He poked at the bruise on his arm and asked himself where it came from. I snatched a joint from the glove compartment and offered him a medicinal hit.
"You know who was a pothead,"
he said, refusing the dubitch.
"Little Scotty Beckett."
Scotty was a big-eyed rascal who used to run with Spanky. Wore a floppy knit sweater and his baseball cap to the side, but the white boy was all punim and no pathos, and he didn't last long. "Oh, yeah. What about Spanky? Did he do drugs?"
"Spanky didn't do shit but fuck bitches. That's what Spanky did."
I rolled down the window. We still weren't moving very fast, and the stench of marijuana smoke hung guiltily in the air. The myth, is that the little rascals, like a production of Macbeth, are cursed, and they all died horribly premature deaths. Gang member, age, cause of death. Alfalfa, 42, shot 30 times in the face, once for each freckle, in an argument over money. Buckwheat, 49, heart attack. Weezer, 19, army training plane crash. Darla Hood, 47. According to Harmony, he fucked her to death. In reality, hepatitis. Chubsy Ubsy, 21. Had something heavy on his heart. Unrequited love for Miss Crabtree and 300 pounds of fat on a 5-foot frame. Froggy, 16. Hit by truck. Pete the Pup, 7. Swallowed alarm clock. Harmony squirmed in his seat, picking at the still puffy red welts on his back, wondering why he was bleeding. Shit, maybe I was supposed to let him die. Maybe I should have just pushed him out of the car and onto the oily, cracked asphalt of the Harbor Freeway. But what good would it do? Traffic came to a complete halt. A Jaguar, one of those ugly American-made models, was overturned in the fast lane. Its turtlenecked passenger, unhurt, leaning against the median fence and reading a hardback novel you only see at airport bookstores. The rear-ended Honda sedan, with both its back end and its driver flattened and smoking, lay in the middle lane, waiting to be carried to the junk and graveyards, respectively. Jaguar model names sound like rockets. XJS, XJ8, E-Type. Hondas sound like cars designed by pacifists and humanitarian diplomats. The Accord, Civic, Insight. Harmony got out of the car to untangle the snarl. Waving his arms like the crazy man he was, he separated the cars by color, not that of the respective paint jobs, but by the hue of the motorists. If you black, get back. White, to the right. Brown, go around. Yellow, follow the whites and let it mellow. Red, full speed ahead. Mulattoes, full throttle. If he couldn't categorize by sight, he asked the drivers what color they were. Chicano, what color is that? You just can't make up a race, motherfucker. Puto, I got your puto right here, pendejo. You pick a lane, nigga, and stay in it. Get in where you fit in. With cops and flares arrived, and the traffic finally flowing freely, Harmony climbed back into the truck, dusting off his hands like he'd done something. That's how you do shit. Sunshine Sammy taught me that. He used to say, time waits on no man, but niggers wait on anybody with a 25-cent tip. Who the fuck is Sunshine Sammy? Don't you worry about who Sunshine Sammy is. You new niggas got black presidents and golfers. I got Sunshine Sammy, the original little rascal. And by original, I mean the very first one. And let me tell you, when Sunshine Sammy rescued the gang from an impossible predicament, now that was nonpartisan leadership. Harmony slumped in his seat and clasped his hands behind his head and looked out the window and into his past. I flipped on the radio and let the Dodger game fill the silence. How many missed the good old days in Sunshine Sammy? I missed Vin Scully, the dulcet voice of objectivity, calling the play-by-play. For a baseball puritan like myself, the good old days were the days before the designated hitter, interleague play, steroids, and assholes in the outfield, baseball caps perched precariously atop their heads, flying off with every missed cutoff man and pop fly lost in the national pastime sun. They were me and Daddy, our mouths full of Dodger dogs and soda, two black bleacher and Dharma bums sharing the June night heat with the moths, cursing a fifth-place team and longing for the good old days of Garvey, Say, Koufax, Dusty, Drysdale, and Lasorda. For Harmony, any day when he could personify American primitivism was a good old day. It meant that he was still alive, And sometimes even the carnival coon in the dunk tank misses the attention. And this country, the latent high school homosexual that it is, the mulatto passing for white that it is, the Neanderthal incessantly plucking its unibrow that it is,